Good morning, everyone. In the matter of the petition for expungement of the criminal record belonging to T.O., can we please have appearances of counsel? You need to unmute yourself.
Sorry. Jennifer Radel, Mr. Chief Justice from Gibbons PC on behalf of the petitioner.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justices, and may it please the court. Erin Campbell, Assistant Hudson County Prosecutor on behalf of the State of New Jersey.
Tartillis?
Good morning, Chief Martillis, the law from the McCarter English, on behalf of all former and living governors appearing at the meeting today.
Good morning, Your Honor. Tess Borden, American Civil Liberties Union of New Jersey, on behalf of AMICI, ACLU of New Jersey, New Jersey Institute for Social Justice, and Volunteer Lawyers for Justice.
Welcome, counsel. Ms. Radel, please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justices, and may it please the court. May I reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes, please go ahead.
Thank you. This appeal presents a narrow question. Can a person who has been pardoned be deprived of statutory benefit based solely upon the fact of a prior conviction? As all the published authority in this state holds, the answer to that question is no. The appellate division's ruling to the contrary is incorrect, creates an unnecessary constitutional issue, and should be reversed. Our argument is premised upon a few basic principles. There doesn't seem to be any dispute that a pardon affords the recipient complete forgiveness, and it relieves any legal burdens and further punishment that would otherwise arise from a conviction. As courts often describe it, a pardon relieves a person of the legal disabilities attendant to the conviction. That is not dependent upon any act of the legislature. It's a matter of constitutional and common law. So any law that deprives a legal or a statutory benefit based upon the type of conviction is the type of legal disability that a pardon eliminates. As Judge Ashrafi said in LB, a pardon supersedes the fact he was convicted. If the conviction itself causes the disqualification, the pardon erases it. We really think that it's that simple. And all of the published authority in New Jersey that applies this standard has created a distinction between those statutory disqualifications that are premised upon the fact of conviction alone, like the public office statute in Brzezinski, and those that are premised upon some measure of the applicant's moral character, like the lottery licensing in Storchella or the pension benefits in Hozier. And what those cases hold is that while the statutory disqualifications based upon the applicant's character are not affected by a pardon, those that are premised upon the fact of conviction alone are. Those are the very legal disabilities that arose from the conviction. Here, based purely upon the fact of a prior or subsequent conviction, 52:2C-2 disqualifies applicants from what would otherwise be their statutory right to have an expungement application considered. That is a statutory disability that's eliminated by a pardon. The appellate division rejected this fairly straightforward application of the legal effect of a pardon to the expungement statute. And in doing so, the court created a constitutional issue, one that this court could avoid by holding, as it should, that a pardon eliminates the statutory bar. But if the court holds that it doesn't, the court must confront the separation of powers issue. So separation of powers issue is also based upon some fundamental legal principles. The New Jersey Constitution requires separation of powers between the three branches of government. As applied between the executive and the legislature cannot interfere with any power of the executive that the Constitution grants solely to the executive, and the pardon power is one of those. And as a result, and as courts have expressly held, the legislature cannot change or undermine the legal effect of a pardon without violating the separation of powers. So consistent with the canon of construction that requires the court to adopt any reasonable interpretation of the statute that does not raise a constitutional issue, the expungement statute must be interpreted to give the pardon its full effect by eliminating any statutory bar that arises purely from the fact of conviction. Petitioner's record consists of two criminal convictions arising from guilty pleas, both over 20 years ago and both of which have been pardoned. As a matter of law, the governor's pardon relieved him of any further punishment or legal disabilities arising from those convictions. Because everyone in this case agrees that his application for expungement was otherwise proper, interpreting the statute to deny this petitioner an expungement based purely upon the fact of a pardoned conviction strikes at the heart of the executive's exclusive authority and would violate the separation of powers. The petitioner respectfully requests that the court reverse the appellate division's ruling. I'd be happy to address any questions the court may have.
Is it your position that expungement is automatic following the grant of a pardon, or that there is additional analysis that is required?
There is additional analysis that would be required. So the pardon would only extinguish any statutory bar based upon the fact of conviction. But, for example, the other provisions of the expungement statute may apply. So, for example, an expungement may be denied if the records are the subject of a pending civil lawsuit, or an expungement may be denied if in a particular case an objector makes the argument that the public need for access to the records would outweigh the private interest in an expungement.
And in that context, let's say the latter example, could the fact of the conviction notwithstanding the pardon be considered? In other words, if someone objects based upon a, I'm not talking about this case, but in a case where there's a violent crime, perhaps, could someone object based on public safety, need to have access to those records, considering those convictions notwithstanding the pardon?
Under Section 14, I think the guidance would be the court's decision in Coleman. And while that case holds that you can't, even apart from a pardon, you can't consider categorical things such as the exact crime, but you would be able to consider the facts, any undisputed facts, such as exactly what occurred. But the fact of conviction alone, I don't think would be appropriate under Coleman in any event, but certainly would be excluded by the pardon.
Well, it's the conviction that allows people to say that there are no longer disputed facts. I mean, once you put aside the conviction, then you don't have any factual findings. So when you're talking about undisputed facts, and a trial has disputed facts, most of them do. Once you set aside the conviction, like, what undisputed facts are we talking about?
So if you look at the case law in Sorcella and Hozier and Gregorio and LB, the distinction is that just the fact that the applicant was convicted cannot be considered. But if a statute has a moral character requirement or an honorable service requirement, the facts underlying the crime that gave rise to the conviction could be considered. So,
where do you get that distinction from, Ms. Rado? The component, the honorable component, where does that come from? Because I didn't see anything. I know you made that argument, but I don't see it anywhere.
I think if you read all of the cases in New Jersey together, Sorcello, Hozier, Gregorio, and LB, that distinction.
I still have a headache from it, but.
Pardon?
I still have a headache from it, but.
So in Sorcello, the licensing statute prohibited a lottery license if the applicant's character was such that it might tarnish the lottery or was not of a good moral character. And that, in a particular applicant, had a pardon. The question in that case
I'm thinking was, more of the pensions and the gun permit issue.
Yes. So the pension.
If we had a pardon, can someone now obtain a state pension with the expungement? or obtain a permit to purchase a firearm?
The pension statute does not disqualify, and to my knowledge, at least as insofar as the statute was in effect at the time of that case. The statute did not disqualify someone, I believe, based upon a conviction. That statute instead said that you had to establish honorable service in order to be eligible for a pension. So the argument in that case,
if you're convicted of some improper, such as taking bribes or funneling money towards a personal issue, would that involve a moral character? But it would be the conviction that proves that you had that lack of moral character?
The case law draws a somewhat fine but clear distinction between the facts and that the offense was committed and the fact of conviction. So this goes a bit to the argument that a pardon doesn't flow from a sense of innocence, but rather still presumes the underlying guilt.
So under your approach, and I'm looking at the expungement statute, which has certain exceptions, I'm looking at 2C52-27, which says that when a person's record is expunged, that person still must reveal the fact of conviction if applying for a position in law enforcement or the judicial branch. Now, is it your position that doesn't apply because that is a civil disability? I'm trying to figure out what parts of the expungement statute are you saying still apply and which don't apply, or do no provisions apply?
I don't think that the provision based upon the detail of the effect of expungement has any disqualifications based upon a conviction.
Well, so, if a person is granted an expungement, let's say for aggravated arson, aggravated sexual assault, or even murder, under our expungement statute, in response to a question by an employer or anyone else of law enforcement and judiciary, the person can say, I've never been convicted of a crime. Now, are you saying that a person pardoned for an offense can go about, in response to questions from an employer or other people, and say, I've never been convicted of a crime?
Not without an expungement.
Well, okay. But you're saying, I understand, but you're saying the pardon for such offenses, it could be murder, aggravated arson, aggravated sexual assault, will entitle that person to an expungement, correct?
Not automatically, provided, again, that all of the other criteria are met. So if an objection were made under another provision, that provision would still apply.
But there aren't many other provisions to bar an expungement. So if a person is expungement eligible for a crime, even for a serious one, what is going to be the basis for barring that person for an expungement? You're talking about other provisions. What other provisions, really?
I think 52-14 is one of the major ones. An objector can always object to a petition made under Section 2 in a particular instance and make the case that in a particular instance the public benefit to having the records accessible is outweighs the private interest. So I think that whether objectors have used that very much doesn't make it not available to them.
So what I'm trying to understand, as you're saying, the pardon power is somehow negating certain elements of the expungement statute, not others. Why is it negating that part? I'm trying to figure out the picking and the choosing that you're doing through the pardon power, as you're saying, well, it negates this part of the statute, but it doesn't negate that part of the statute. And trying to see whether or not there's any principled basis for your argument as you're doing that.
The principled basis is that it only extinguishes in the expungement statute or any other statute a eligibility criteria or disqualification that is based upon the fact of conviction. So any statute that excludes someone from a statutory benefit based upon a conviction cannot be applied as to a pardoned conviction. So, that doesn't mean that other criteria can't.
So is a government record standing alone that merely records an act that has occurred in the judiciary, a civil disability? Assuming the person can still vote, get employment, can't be discriminated against, why is that a civil disability? And I say that because you started off by saying this is an act of forgiveness, not an act of forgetfulness. And the expunging the record is, in part, an act of amnesia. Okay? Or, so I'm trying to figure out how this is applying to the expungement statute in that respect. Go ahead.
There is simply a difference between a pardon and an expungement, and we're not making the argument that every pardon leads to an expungement. I think that the state of the law as it exists doesn't support the fact that the existence of the records itself is a civil disability. What the legal disability here is a statute that excludes convicted offenders, where and that statute can't be applied as to someone who has received a pardon, because the pardon was intended, and the legal effect of the pardon is to eliminate any legal burdens or punishments that otherwise would be exacted based upon the conviction.
Counsel, as I understand your argument, you are only asking for a ruling that holds that as a result of the pardon granted by Governor Christie to T.O., he is eligible to apply for expungement. And then whatever rights he's able to secure with a successful expungement application will flow from the statute, the statutory scheme governing expungements, but the pardon gets him in the door. Am I correct?
Correct, Justice. In this case, everyone agreed that that was the only thing that closed the door. So the practical effect in this case would be that petitioner would be granted an expungement. But yes, in terms of the legal ruling, it is only that the pardon, you can't shut the door based upon a prior conviction as to a pardoned offender.
And, so help us understand. The door that was shut was the fact that he had more than one conviction, and that was ineligibility that Governor Christie's pardon eliminated, correct?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
So help us understand your constitutional argument. Because what I've heard you say is that if you don't get by Section 2A, the fact that the prior conviction bars you from getting in the door, then there is a separation of powers issue. But if Section 14 were to apply and a persuasive argument were presented and expungement were not granted, that does not pose a constitutional argument. How do you reconcile those two?
So the constitutional argument arises if the statute is interpreted to bar his application in its entirety, because that would mean that the pardon, the legal effect of the pardon being that the fact of the pardon cannot exclude him if the statute says no one who has been convicted. A pardoned offender can't be within the definition of no one who has been convicted, because otherwise that would allow the legislature to alter the legal effect of the pardon. The legal effect of the pardon being it eliminates any legal burden that results from a conviction. Section 14 allows considerations guided by the court's ruling in Coleman as that are much, they're akin to the applicant's character, what happened, how much harm was attributed. And those are the types of considerations that the court's rulings in Sorcello and Hozier permitted when they said that the moral character and honorable service requirements could still be applied, notwithstanding a pardon.
Yeah, your first argument is constitutional avoidance. I understand that. So going through the Chief's question, assuming that the legislature purposely excluded pardon, because it's not there. They were aware of it, they didn't put it in. Now we're just dealing with your constitutional argument. Are you arguing that the expungement statute itself does not apply in any respect whatsoever, but because the executive grant of clemency cannot be hemmed in any respect by the legislature?
No, we're not arguing that the entire statute would not apply. As I indicated, if, for example, this petitioner or any petitioner who had a pardon also had a pending civil litigation as to which the records were relevant, the expungement statute would preclude an expungement. That doesn't affect the legal effect of a pardon, and provisions such as that and Section 14 would continue to apply. So we're only...
So stated otherwise, you're conceding that there's no constitutional impediment to applying other objections once you get beyond Section 2A.
Provided that those objections aren't based upon the fact of conviction, yes, that we would agree.
That argument makes a lot of sense when you apply it to the exception for civil litigation. To me, it's a little bit dicier when you are saying that if someone were to raise an issue based upon that has a sort of a character element in it, the fact of the conviction would be relevant to that consideration. See what I mean by that distinction?
I do, Justice. And it's a fine, but I think in the cases a relatively clear distinction that when you're considering the factors under 14 and under Coleman or under a good faith or honorable service requirement, you're not talking about the fact that he was convicted. You are talking about what the person did and has done with their lives. So the fact that they were convicted is irrelevant. The finding of guilt is irrelevant. It is the nature of the person that is relevant. That's the line in the case.
And I understand the argument, but it seems like when you are saying that the person's character is such that the public interest in those records being available outweighs the private interest in expungement, you are talking about conduct that was the subject of the conviction, not just conduct that someone out there says occurred, but it's conduct that resulted in a conviction, and the fact of the conviction is not entirely irrelevant to that inquiry. Would you agree with that?
I think if someone is pardoned, the fact of conviction is irrelevant. It is, but it has to be based upon the facts of the offense, not the fact of the conviction.
I don't understand that distinction, going back to Justice Patterson's questions. Like, in a murder case that has been tried 30 years ago, upon your position that the fact of the conviction no longer applies, what does that mean? It's the conviction itself, which is a statement about the underlying facts. You know, and I think this is where Justice Patterson was going on that. On that question.
I'm trying to think of a different way to articulate it, given the court's concern, but you have to think of how the statute reads. If the statute reads, no person who has been convicted may apply for a license, no person who has been convicted may get an expungement. The fact of a person cannot suffer that deprivation of a statutory right, a benefit that the legislature has intended to create based upon the fact of a pardon conviction, because that would allow the legislature to continue to deprive benefits based upon a conviction the governor has determined.
Let's use Justice Alvin's example. Not, and I'm taking this away from your client's case, obviously, very different. The 30-year-old murder case, application for an expungement is made. The victim's family objects and says he killed our relative. This person is dangerous. Where is the line drawn? Since the basis for the victim's family saying this occurred is presumably very, very closely related to the conviction itself, can that objection be entertained by the court that's considering the expungement application?
I think under the way the New Jersey case law and the rule that we encourage the court to adopt is that, yes, it can. It just can't say, I'm not going to hear your objection because you have been convicted.
Is it your position? That generally, looking at our jurisprudence, and the jurisprudence that goes back more than 100 years, federal and state, is that a pardon basically is an act of forgiveness, but not an act of forgetfulness. We don't forget the conviction. We forgive the conviction, and that's why we remove the civil disabilities. Is that the general theory behind it?
That is the general theory, but to give meaning to the relief of the civil disabilities, we have to interpret statutes that base eligibility based upon the lack of conviction to not include pardon convictions.
But the reason why I'm asking that question is
if I can just...
Go ahead, Justice.
As I understand your position, you're hewing very carefully to the prior case law that recognized other settings where moral turpitude or other forms of character analysis was still relevant, like the pensions case that you mentioned before, and the carry, the weapon carry case. I mean, those are situations applying the principle that you're asking us to stick with, that it's forgiveness of the conviction, but not forgetfulness that the incident took place, so that when assessing the character in some other setting, that incident is still a relevant consideration. As I understand your position, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're trying to apply that longstanding case law to the expungement statute that allows for other considerations of the fact that the act didn't take place. These acts took place. They may not be sufficient to override the reasons for granting an expungement, but they're not off the table. It's not an ineligibility based on the conviction itself. Am I understanding your position? You're trying to preserve our prior case law.
Yeah, exactly. I'm just asking that case law and that rule and the distinction be applied here.
I don't see how that necessarily is inconsistent with the state's position. So take all the cases, the lottery case, the gun possession case. The person can come in and say, I was convicted. Yeah, I was convicted of this crime, but you can't use that against me. I've been pardoned. Okay? So no civil disability that arises from the conviction can be used against me, even though people may know about the condition. The expungement statute is saying the public, once it's expunged, the public doesn't have a right to know that you were convicted and that you can walk around and say, I've never been convicted of a crime. That's something very, very different from all of those cases. I know that the Justice Levesque is shaking her head and saying no, but
yeah.
I want to see what you're going to say.
I have a follow-up.
Well, I want to hear what she
has. I have a follow-up question to Justice Alvin's.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Answer and then answer Justice Levesque's question. Go ahead.
So, Justice Alvin, the difference is that it really is very narrowly that the fact of being convicted can't cause the disqualification or the denial. That doesn't mean under the case law as it exists that the fact that a person did something and the facts of that offense may not be considered if the statutory requirement is, does the person have good moral character? Now, it may be given various weight depending upon how long ago it occurred and any other measure of factors that would otherwise apply, but it just can't be the fact that they were convicted. And I don't think that the state actually addresses that case law and that distinction at all. They sort of merely say that the law says it doesn't alleviate all consequences. That is exactly what the case law says. It doesn't relieve all consequences of the crime and of the offense, but it does relieve all legal burdens or punishments that would flow from the conviction, the fact of a conviction.
Your position is a more modulated position than that taken by the amici former governors, which I believe would say there is no automatic entitlement to expungement, but you're simply saying the pardon eliminates the bar that was cited by the state in this instance to allow you to even proceed with the remainder of the expungement analysis. Is that correct?
That's correct. I think that we would agree that it seems difficult to conceive of a way that a pardon could be given its full effect without the expungement, but our legal position is much more measured, as Your Honor has indicated.
What do we know in legislative... I'm sorry. Chief, go ahead.
You anticipated my question, and I want to get the sense of the scope from a practical perspective of your argument. Under 14, it lists in multiple grounds for denial. The first one is there is statutory basis for denying relief, and you get beyond that through your interpretation of the impact of a pardon. Section B, which we've talked about, says you can deny relief if the need for the availability of records outweighs the private interest. Can you give us an example of when that would apply, if an individual has been pardoned?
I certainly can't say that there wouldn't be some set of facts. The prosecutor's office, their brief indicates some concern that there may be offenders that shouldn't be entitled to an expungement, perhaps because there's some disagreement about the basis of the pardon or whether someone was deserving. So I can't necessarily give you a set of facts, but I think 14 and the court's ruling in Coleman allows it to be any number of things, the egregiousness of the crime, perhaps something about the public nature of an offense, but all of those would be very fact-dependent, but they would be permitted under 14.
So an egregious murder could result in a pardon and eligibility for expungement, but at the same time, the egregiousness of it would justify not expunging the records? Is that what you're telling us?
I think the particular facts of any case, in murder, for example, if it were something of a public nature, if it were, I'm not sure that I can come up with the facts that would satisfy 14, but yes, I think theoretically, the pardoned conviction makes you eligible. The application gets considered. But then under 14, it's up to an objector to come forward and say that in this particular instance, if an expungement is inappropriate because the access to the public record is necessary.
What about a situation where someone is convicted of sexual abuse of children, pardoned, then seeks expungement, and the argument made about the public interest is that with expungement, I'm leaving aside Megan's Law and all those considerations for the moment, if this person applies for a job at a school, those records should be available to the school when they do their criminal background check because this person poses a threat to children. Is that an example of where the facts that underlie a conviction, in your view, could be considered in the denial of expungement but the conviction itself is not disqualifying.
Yes, I think if the objection were based upon the facts of the offenses, as you stated, you know, the particular acts, then yes, I think that would be appropriate.
So based upon that, do we accept the facts as established by the conviction? Does the conviction establish by itself the egregiousness of the offense? Murder, aggravated sexual assault, aggravated arson, so on?
Whatever facts are deemed proven, the facts that are deemed proven by virtue of a conviction is what would be permitted to be considered under Coleman, but not the fact that a trial resulted in a conviction.
I don't understand that at all. The trial results in a conviction is how you enter a judgment of conviction. So if someone wants to talk about the person's bad moral character, they'll probably arise from a sexual assault or a murder. Do we look at the conviction as establishing those facts? Or are you saying, I don't look at the conviction, look at the trial and figure out for yourself what the facts are?
I don't think that you can't look at the conviction to determine what facts have been established. Again, the question is, does the statute or the regulation preclude or disqualify an applicant based upon the fact that there is a conviction? And so I don't think looking at the underlying record runs afoul of that under the line of cases that I was discussing with Justice Lavecchio.
So play that out in the real terms. Let's use the sexual assault of a child case. The applicant for the expungement said, no, I didn't. I maintained my innocence throughout that trial. The only people who said that I did that was the jury who tried my case, and that's been pardoned. So this should not be a consideration on my application for an expungement because I am innocent. Where does that lead us?
Well, the well-established law is that the pardon doesn't accept the innocence. And frankly, I just don't know what what is deemed to be determined facts in that instance, but there are facts that had to have been determined, you know, whether you would look at the statute or the like. But the
So your applicant then says, I'm entitled to a presumption of innocence. That's what I walked into this trial with. I was convicted, but that's now been pardoned, so I'm not convicted. And I am telling you right now that was not a real allegation. I was innocent. So can that be considered in that public interest, private interest weighing that the statute tells us has to be done?
I think the break in that chain, Justice Patterson, is where you said, I have been pardoned, so I don't, that conviction no longer exists. The pardon doesn't eliminate fact of the conviction. What it does is prevent any punishments or deprivation of legal benefits based upon.
You're absolutely right. I misstated it, but let's say the person just argues that conviction's been pardoned, and I never committed that crime. I'm not saying that has anything to do with your case, but
understood.
We obviously have to be concerned about some case where it could be relevant.
Yes, understood. But unfortunately for that hypothetical applicant, his or her maintenance of innocence just doesn't flow from the pardon.
Can I see, so we don't get too mired in, there's going to be a judge sitting on the bench hearing the expungement application and hearing the objectors, correct?
Correct.
And somebody comes in and says, well, I was pardoned and I'm innocent. And presumably the objector and the prosecutor would say, well, judge, 12 jurors concluded that they were guilty. And the judge would hear that and consider that. And likewise, the objector would say, and in the transcript of your plea or of your testimony or of whatever,
this was brought out. And the judge would hear about all of those horrific things. And also the defendant's claim of, well, innocent, it wasn't me. And presumably make a conclusion that these things preclude the expungement or don't preclude the expungement. In other words, all these things we're throwing out there and getting mired in, there, it doesn't, I think you said, or Justice Lebecki said, it essentially doesn't change history. Events happen. Those events can be made clear to the judge. The judge can consider them in deciding whether to give the expungement. And all of these hypotheticals are largely irrelevant to the process. It's a long statement, but is that right?
I think that it is. I think that the only quibble that I might have is that when the applicant comes forth and says, I was pardoned, I am innocent, as a matter of law, that just isn't the effect of the pardon.
Understood. But the person can say all they want, I didn't do it. And the judge can hear that and say, that's interesting. I have here that 12 people decided you did. Next question. I mean, it's not as if the judge is sitting up there with his brain fried. He's listening to everybody state the reason there should or should not be an expungement based on the statute that's being applied, correct?
Correct. And the only thing that the judge can't do, in our view, under Section 2 is say, is bar it.
Okay, tell me what you're thinking about this. Historically, common law, the acceptance of a pardon is a confession of guilt. Am I wrong about that? I've seen that throughout the cases for the last 100 years. I'm looking even at one of our 1857, pardon implies guilt. So a pardon does not suggest innocence. We accept the person is guilty for a pardon. It's even a confession of guilt. It's we forgive. It's a forgiveness of the offense. Am I wrong about that?
No, you're not, Justice Alvin. But that forgiveness means that you can't be further punished or be deprived of any legal benefits. That's our argument.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, Ms. Rader. We'll have you back for rebuttal. Mr. Artiles.
Good morning, Chief, and I apologize for the technical issues leading up to this morning. We can all, if nothing else, rest assured that the McCarter server is so safe it won't allow the justices of the Supreme Court into our network. I am very frustrated by that, but I apologize. But I appear before you, honorably, as counsel to all the former governors of our state who are going to be arguing here today as amici. The former governors appear before you to urge the court to do what the lower court did not hear, which is to focus on the Constitution of 1947. Tellingly, in her trial court opinion, Judge Ospina told Petitioner Odom, and I quote, I hope you appeal this decision. This is unique, a different area, and I think it is one that should be appealed to highlight it, and hopefully we can change something about it. Justices, we appear today with the sincere hope that you can change that something. The powers afforded to the governor in the Constitution are clear. As this court knows very well, the governor of New Jersey enjoys vast power. He or she has the power to do many things, few of which more sacred than the power to pardon. That power, coming specifically from Article 5, Section 2, was considered by Governor Christie the most amazing authority he had as governor. In its simplest form, to borrow from this court, the pardon can be viewed as allowing one to, and I quote, participate in life's daily activities without the stigma and consequences of a criminal record, matter of TB. And while this court was referring to an expungement in the TB matter, it is precisely in this matter that every former governor viewed his or her pardon power. When they took the extreme measure of granting a pardon, and it is an extreme one, they did so with the intention of removing all disabilities of a conviction. No governor ever granted a pardon with the intention of only removing part of the pardoned individual's prior acts. nor did they seek to grant only partial liberty, liberty to vote or serve on a juror. Doing so would belie the entire premise of the pardon, which is to give an individual a clean slate by removing the penalties of a conviction. I'm going to be far less measured here and agree with Justice Alvin. This is precisely what Governor Christie thought on January 12, 2018, when he pardoned Petitioner Odom for his prior conviction. It was a true forgiveness. In order for the pardon to be viewed as such and given its full effect, pursuant to the Constitution, this court, I respectfully urge, should use its great power to lend a critical eye here, something the lower courts were unable to do. Judge Ospina clearly recognized...
Mr. Artiles, can you help us with the back and forth we had with Ms. Radel? Your argument, of course, says you get beyond the statutory impediment under Section 2A, 52-2A. There's no longer a legal disability based on the fact of the conviction that bars you from applying. Is expungement automatic, or are other considerations appropriate short of the fact of consideration to analyze whether the record should be expunged?
Yep, thank you, Chief. And so the governors do see it as automatic, and one where the criteria that leading up to the decision whether to pardon an individual or not, all of those factors that were being discussed earlier are ones properly before the governor when she or he is deciding whether to pardon someone.
So Mr. Artiles, I want to be clear about this based upon your response to the Chief Justice's question. You're saying that the Expungement Act is inapplicable? Are you saying that?
Yes, Justice Alvin. I'm urging the court to view it as such.
Okay, so my one of even a record that is expunged requires a person who has been convicted of a crime to answer to a request from a judicial employer or a law enforcement employer that I've been convicted of a crime. So you would say that those provisions do not apply, that the person can go and seek employment with the state police or even apply for a judicial appointment and say I've never been convicted of a crime. That's your position.
That is our position, and that is how we read the constitutional powers of the pardon.
Mr. Achilles, can you address how that is not in any way an impediment of the constitutional legislative power placed in another branch of government?
Yeah, we generally view it as one that is properly before the governor, and the legislature should not be meddling in such affairs. But if we're forced to go down the legislative analysis route, we think there's plenty of case law that would allow for the statutory bar to be lifted here, right? Specifically the Gregorio case.
Your argument would also apply to the judiciary, not to the legislature. So, for instance, a person is convicted of misappropriation of client funds, many client funds, and is disbarred based upon the conviction. Your argument leads to the conclusion is that the judiciary would have to welcome that person with open arms, the conviction, and everything surrounding the conviction disappears. Am I correct about that, given your interpretation?
That's correct. We have absolute trust in our governor and the advisory panel that he or she is able to empanel to consider and vet all of these issues, all of whom should be determined by him or her in deciding whether to issue the pardon. And that pardon is a true forgiveness, allowing someone to do more than just vote or serve on a juror, right? They should be able to apply for a job or apply to college and not have to deal with the disabilities that were incumbent on their conviction.
My last question
so,
to you is...
Sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Justin LeBecca. You go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'll go after you.
My only question to you is, we know that the authority is great, but there's nothing in the Constitution that says that it will be used wisely. I mean, whole swaths of people can be pardoned, and in fact, it's occurred in states, and many governors pardon people, and even presidents pardon people at the end of their terms. They don't want the political consequences. So, you accept the power is great, but it doesn't necessarily ensure wisdom. You agree?
I agree, but I do think that all of our governors would have the wisdom to make the correct decision in deciding whether to pardon someone. And I think, look, as this court has seen through the successful drug court program, right, the court's well aware of the stigma and prejudice associated with criminal records and its incredibly discriminatory nature that plagues our black and brown communities, right? There's a disproportionate plaguing of those communities. And I think viewing it this way is in line with the larger criminal justice reform that has been afoot in our state for the last decade. Viewing it as such, I think, is firmly in line with the state's thinking there.
Can drug court defendants who've had their records, who are pardoned, can drug court defendants who've successfully completed their drug court program and are back on the right track apply to the state police for a job and not have to disclose the prior conviction?
If they were pardoned, Chief, I'm sorry, I may have not.
No, not if pardoned.
Not if pardoned, can they not? I do not know the answer to that, Chief.
Justice LeBecca.
Does your pardon argument, Mr. Achilles, require us to re-examine the previous holdings that considered someone who had been pardoned but nevertheless was precluded from pension benefits or other settings where the person's character or morals were considered?
Should they be reconsidered?
Yes, because your position, I thought, is saying that the governor's issuance of a pardon eliminates the loss of any civil rights. So does that argument extend to even consider moral turpitude considerations of pardoned offenses?
Yes, because I think those determinations should be made previously by the governor.
So you are now arguing that a pardon is the equivalent of innocence. Your argument would have us declare that a pardon overrides the judicial process, the fact of the state's choice to execute and administer the laws that result in a conviction. Is that correct?
That is correct. In line with how many other states have used it.
But states in general a number of states have done this legislatively, correct? Have created essentially an exception to their expungement, or essentially eliminated exceptions to expungement for pardon. So at least some other states have acknowledged a need to have the legislature limit the expungement exceptions for purposes of acknowledging the governor's pardon power.
That's correct.
You agree with that?
I do.
Okay. Now when you say that governors consider when they pardon, the pardon determination takes into account all of these considerations. We know that the pardon power is very broad, and there's really not particular guidelines for how the governor makes that determination. Are you saying that implicitly, when a governor pardons someone, they are saying, to use the example we've used a couple of times in this argument, that somebody who comes, that when I as governor have pardoned this person, therefore, someone down the road who says that there is a public interest in the criminal record being available for reasons of public safety, what have you, I am making a determination that that person, hypothetically, in the future is wrong. That that this Spartan determination means that that determination is made for that future concern on public safety. Is that what you're saying?
That is. And I further argue, Justice, that it is in the public interest that we should be viewing it as such. Truly allow someone to lead a life unencumbered by the prior commission.
So, counsel, I'm trying to reconcile your argument with our recognition of what a pardon means historically within the state and also within our federal law. And I'm just citing one case, but this is a theme that seems to follow throughout the case law. Pardon implies guilt. If there is no guilt, there is no ground for forgiveness. That's one of our New Jersey 1857. If you look at Burdick, the United States Supreme Court case, and many other cases say that, and your argument seems to be completely untethered to our case law. Am I mistaken about that?
I don't know if I'm completely untethered, Justice, but we are asking for a fresh set of eyes here. To consider this case. It is an incredibly unique opportunity, and one that I think Judge Ospina was sort of getting at earlier. She seemed to be frustrated, and I think, you know, this court has an opportunity to deal with that frustration in a way that would give Petitioner Odom back the liberties that he deserves as a result of that pardon. He paid his price, he's done his time, now he should receive the full benefit of the pardon. Not
but what Judge Ospina was addressing, if I correctly understood the issue before her, was, is this person disqualified because of two convictions? I mean, that's clearly an issue that's before the court, that's clearly an issue that she was considering. You're arguing for something beyond what was considered by the trial court, correct?
Correct.
And you don't accept Professor Williston's standard, which has been adopted by many, many courts throughout the nation. Is that fair?
As painful as it is to disagree with Professor Williston, yes, Chief, that's correct.
But the conviction itself and the underlying facts cannot be considered in these other areas, including the expungement statute and other bases to object under it. That's your view?
That is all factors are to be considered by the governor.
Any other questions? Anything you'd like to add, Mr. Hertzlis?
Nothing more. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you. Ms. Borden.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I would like to, on behalf of MEG, the Civil Rights Organization, address two points. The first is responsive to the conversations you've had with counsel before me, and the second, quite briefly, is just to address the legislative history, because even if we are within statutory interpretation, TO still wins here. So first, I think what these conversations have grappled with is the ultimate question: what is the full effect of the pardon? And we know as a matter of separation of powers that whatever that full effect is, the legislature, and indeed the judiciary, cannot constrain it. But Your Honor can determine its scope. Now, that's a weighty question, and whether or not you need to determine its full scope today, I guess I'll just say I don't think you need to determine its full scope today. At a minimum, we know with fidelity to the case law, Storchella, Gregorio, Osher, as Ms. Radel has laid out, we know that at a minimum, a pardon's effect is to relieve or remove the legal disabilities attendant upon conviction. That's at a minimum. And so the question then is, what is a legal disability? I think Amici, the governors, argue persuasively as a matter of policy that the maintenance of criminal records is a legal disability. And I believe a major civil rights organizations know what it is. It is called in the scholarship a civil death. And I'm grateful to Mr. Artiles for naming just how disproportionately that civil death impacts Black and Brown communities in our state and in the country. But whether or not a civil disability necessary, or the removal of a civil disability necessarily means automatic expungement, I think is a question that has not been answered by any court in our state. If it does, it means that the expungement statute, as I believe Justice Alvin asked earlier, is simply beside the point. And so we don't need to try to fit the automatic expungement into the statute under, for example, 52.6. We just need to say, again, it's beside the point. I think, compellingly, a petitioner might go before a court and argue, I received my pardon, it removes the legal disability as a matter of due process, I need an expungement. You know, could seek an equitable, judicially created remedy to say I have a liberty interest in being relieved of these disabilities. A court would then have to determine what that expungement looked like, whether, to Justice Alvin's question, it included what is now presently, I'm looking at my notes, 5227C, you know, such that it's still available in certain employment applications. Again, that's not something we have to fit within this statute. It would be a question that either the law division in that first instance or your honors now could opine on. What is the full effect? Again, TO doesn't need that to win here. Returning to what we know at a minimum, which I believe is Ms. Radel's argument, we know at a minimum that it removes the disability associated with conviction. And so to Justice LaVecchia's questioning earlier today and to her powerful dissent in JS, what we know is that means anytime a statute says someone with a conviction go over here, someone without one go over here, the person who receives the pardon gets to go to the side of the room or the side of the statute that says people without a conviction belong here. So anytime.
So we understand that. We understand that, as you can tell from the discussion that's taken place so far today, we understand that argument. We'll hear what the state has to say on it. What's the logical import of that argument with respect to the rest of the expungement statute? The question you say we don't need to know today, the answer to today, what will this opinion foretell?
So I think this opinion, most narrowly, could simply affirm what we know from Hozier, what we know from Sorcella, which is that any time the legislature, in an expungement statute or otherwise, creates a bar to or an exclusion to certain benefits, privileges, or rights based on a conviction, that a pardon removes that. That's certainly so in an expungement statute. It's also so in the statute that sets up the eligibility for Board of Education membership. It must be so in any legislative enactment. So with respect to the expungement statute, it means that the conviction bars, both the numeric cap in 52.2a, as well as, which of course is the case in TO's appeal before you, as well as in 2C with respect to drug offenses, as in the LB case, and 2B, which hasn't been litigated yet, any of those conviction bars in Section 2 must be removed. I don't think, if your Honor's opinion is as narrow as Ms. Radel suggests, I don't think it means that 5214 doesn't apply. I certainly don't think it means that 5227C, with respect to the availability of records for law enforcement corrections or judicial employment, is any kind of bar. It's simply align it. Wherever the statute says conviction, you don't get X, your Honor must cross out the word conviction. It's simply the removal of a bar. Does that answer your Honor's question, Chief?
In part. So let's assume we issue a ruling that's consistent with what you just said, remand it back to the trial court, because even in LB, on which you rely, the trial court went to the merits after deciding that it wasn't a bar. The state stands up on remand and says, we object under one of the other grounds of Section 14. What is your position at that point? May that objection be heard, or is there some impediment based on the pardon or the Constitution that stands in the way?
Our position is that on the limited view, simply with fidelity to Sorcella, that may be heard. The fact of a pardon, I would suggest, is relevant to the trial court consideration. As a constitutional separation of powers question, if Your Honors are to go broader and find that expungement is automatic following to give full effect to the pardon, of course, that may not be heard. But again, the limited view, and I think all that the case law, setting aside public policy, but all that the case law requires is that any exclusion based on conviction must be removed by the grant of the pardon. I would say finally, on this point, Your Honors know, and we have briefed time and again before this court, that the legal disabilities, the collateral consequences of conviction are enormous. I would say, though, that in some rare cases, the maintenance of records may indeed be in the public interest, and I think the legislature was wise to include that in Section 14. We obviously wouldn't want the prosecutor's office to argue that too often. We would like it to be reserved only for exceptional cases, but for all the reasons that we advocate for transparency, for example, around police disciplinary records or official misconduct, the result of internal investigations, I think there are some times where a record may be, the maintenance of the record may be in the public interest. For the average civilian, for Mr. Tito, that is not the case.
Is
there a recognition to some extent that the record-keeping function is not necessarily an executive branch function? For example, the courts have their own records, their own systems of records, they require certain records, and the executive can't tell us how to keep them or how to administer the judiciary. Is that your recognition of that fact?
I think it is in part, Justice Solomon. I also think, though, this is a more complicated separation of powers argument than I think the court to decide today. I do think, quite academically, the governor, the executive, is the chief law enforcement officer. The attorney general, the prosecutor's office is below them, are all part of the executive. And so I think, though we haven't briefed it, as a matter of separation of powers, the executive could decide him or herself to steal records, could decide to dismiss charges, could decide after
the fact. But you're not arguing that they can. You're not arguing they can order us to seal our records unless we would have to order that, would we not?
I think that is right, Justice. I think they could effectively consent to a judicial vacatur, but I do not believe, though I hope you won't hold my colleagues to it in a future argument, I don't believe they could order you to seal all your records willingly.
Why not? You're arguing that they can say that to the legislature. I'm trying to understand your argument. You argue that the governor has this peremptory power, why, if it works against the legislature, which is a co-equal branch of government, why would it work against the judiciary, particularly if the judiciary under Section 14 of the expungement statute is doing what you're saying it's doing. It's permitting the records to survive, creating a civil death for your clients, using your term. I'm trying to figure out your distinction. Why the judiciary is somehow superior to the legislature?
Because I'm arguing before the judiciary, Your
Honor.
I apologize if that was the takeaway from my argument. I meant that sort of as a hypothetical. That is the full extent of the separation of powers argument, I believe. We are not arguing, as a matter of law, that this court must decide today that expungement is automatic following the pardon. I think it is an open legal question. There are good policy reasons to say that it ought to be, but I think on the law, as the jurisprudence stands in our state, I am not making that legal argument to you. If I were, or if Your Honors were to consider that, I think the question would be, what is the full effect of the pardon? What does it mean to remove a legal disability? And again, I think there are good arguments to suggest that the maintenance of any record of the criminal conviction, or indeed of the arrest and trial, because the expungement goes to the full criminal record, that the maintenance of that record is a legal disability. That would not be the executive ordering the legislature. It would simply be the judiciary finding that the
pardon power's full effect requires the expungement to be automatic.
The legislature can limit its own power by deferring to the executive, as in the number of states it's done, by saying, in essence, pardons mean that there's expungement. I assume you see no constitutional impediment to that. The legislature's making that determination. So we have an expungement statute in New Jersey that has been amended a number of times, and I think it's fair to say, in general, the legislature has expressed an interest in broadening the opportunities for people in New Jersey with convictions to get expungements. You'd agree with that as well?
Absolutely.
What should we make of the fact that the legislature has never addressed pardons, if anything?
Thank you, Justice Carson, and that's a friendly segue into my second point. We should make absolutely nothing of it except the legislature's affirmation of the decision in LB. And that flows from the canon of construction that the legislature is presumed aware of judicial construction of its enactment. And we know that until this case, courts in New Jersey have only weighed in once on the legal effect of a pardon. The law division did so in a published opinion in LB 15 years ago. And that has been the law that advocates have relied on for the past decade and a half. In our brief, we cite two advocacy organizations that rely on LB just for that proposition. Over the weekend, I double-checked. They've updated their website to reflect clean slate expungement and still rely on LB. And that has sort of been the, if not the law of the land, that has been the judicial construction of the enactment for the past decade and a half. And so the state says in its brief,
that's been the judicial construction of one judge in one county. You're suggesting that a law division decision is the law of the state?
No, and Your Honor, I spoke too quickly. I said that may not be the law of the land, but it's certainly the judicial construction we have.
LP is binding on who?
On the law division judges in that county, I believe. But it is persuasive elsewhere. And so I would say,
a law division judge can disagree. No other law division judge is bound by another law division's decision. Not even another superior court judge is bound by that.
On that judge. Yes, it is typically okay. The opinion of that judge. But what I would say, and so I believe the canon of statutory interpretation that presumes aware that the legislature is aware, you know, obviously is most potent when that opinion comes from Your Honors and then the appellate division, et cetera. I would simply say the fact that this opinion, having been issued a decade and a half ago, has not resulted in the legislature legislating in line with it, I think is unpersuasive.
Would it be fair to say that legislative intent is not the strongest argument that you'd have to advance under the circumstances here?
Perhaps that canon, and I started there because of Justice Patterson's question. I do think, and Justice Patterson made the argument more...
I started in trouble.
I was about to say, Your Honor, you made the argument more persuasively than I did. What is really compelling when it comes to statutory interpretation of the legislative intent, and that's as Justice Patterson said, the fact that for decades now, the legislature has amended the statute and has broadened, as we lay out in detail in our brief, has broadened expungement eligibility. And so I think there is, LB is not, the fact that the legislature has not legislated in line with LB doesn't undo any of what we must infer of their legislative intent from all these amendments time after time to expand eligibility. And so I think if we were to ask, the legislature would say, of course, we didn't mean to exclude pardoned people under 52.2. I think their clear intent has been to expand eligibility. I think it raises real separation of powers arguments if they try to say a conviction pardoned or not. But we have no reason to think they meant conviction pardoned or not. So I think, you know, taking the legislative history over these decades, we should infer a legislative intent to expand opportunities. And then again, on Ms. Radel's reading, all we would be talking about is from Justice LaVecchia's dissent in JF
you know, get the threshold question, are they eligible for consideration under 52.2? And then all the reasons that we've discussed under 52.14 can be raised by the prosecutor or other objector.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Campbell.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. The Health Division here correctly determined that a gubernatorial pardon does not remove the bar to expungement. And the Appellate Division properly declined to carve out a judicial exception to the statute that would expand the pardon power. Petitioner has incorrectly argued here that a pardon removes the statutory bar to expungement. And that is because, as we've discussed, a pardon removes the consequences of the conviction, but not the historical record of it. New Jersey pardon law is rife with examples of what is and is not beyond the pardon power, starting with Cook in 1857. A pardon implies guilt. There's no need for forgiveness if there is no guilt. In SS, the firearms rights case, the court said a pardon eliminates the consequences of the conviction, but not the fact of it. In Tansmore, this court found that a prior conviction can still be used to impeach despite the fact that it was pardoned, because the prior guilt bears on the petition, the witness's credibility, regardless of any remission of punishment. And in Storsella, Brezinski, and Hozier, our courts have found that you can still use the facts of the underlying offenses as a bar, because the pardon wipes out the consequences, but not the moral stain thereof. And in fact, the Brezinski court said that a pardon condition should ordinarily not affect a disqualification unless it's explicitly provided by law. And that's what we have here, a statutory bar explicitly provided by law disqualifying someone with more than one conviction for applying for an expungement. The Appellate Division properly declined to extend the pardon power to expungement. The pardon power does not have safeguards, and it is not subject to checks and balances. Expungement and pardon are two separate remedies that serve two different purposes. As Your Honors have already noted, a pardon can be for any number of crimes, with any number of victims and any level of severity. We've been throwing around hypotheticals about pardon murderers, pardons for aggravated sexual assault. It's not just hypothetical. Governor Barbour of Mississippi pardoned 14 murderers between 2008 and 2012. Here, while petitioner only has two crimes, they're two separate crimes committed 2 years apart. He is subject to that statutory bar. And another individual pardoned on the same day as petitioner has 8 separate convictions. In contrast, expungement is much more formulaic, it's much more uniform, and the nature of the person generally does not come into play. It's only available for certain crimes and a certain number of convictions. If petitioner's position is adopted, there's no longer a per se bar on pardon crimes like sexual assault or murder. Petitioner's burden would also shift the bar from someone who is categorically barred from expungement to someone who's per se eligible. There are a limited number of objections that the state can raise, and the dissent in JS focused on additional safeguards, such as bar against expunging serious offenses. If petitioner's position is adopted, those safeguards disappear. In JNG, the court addressed the Section 14 exception, the public interest exception that the need for records outweighs the right to expungement. And the court there said, even heinous offenses don't overcome the presumption of expungement. That case was DV assault. The only exception right now is the one that LB would be subject to, distribution offenses, where the court can expunge if it's within the public interest, and I would submit that is why the legislature did not address LB, because shortly after LB, she became eligible for expungement under that exception. Our former governors have argued that the pardon is unconditional, but the plain language of TO's pardon say that it's subject to revocation at any time at the discretion of the governor. Should we grant TO an expungement, there's no similar process for unsealing a record. Under 5226, the state only has 5 years to move for vacatur because of a statutory disqualification. The difference is clear. Through executive grace, a pardon restores rights. However, an expungement is the judicial ending of history. A pardon restores rights held prior to conviction, but there is no right to expungement, and an expungement of this type doesn't even exist absent that conviction. While a pardon is defined by the Constitution, its powers are defined by statute, namely 2A167-5, and it states a person may make application for the restoration of the right of suffrage or of such other rights or privileges. Therefore, the legislature has limited the effect of that pardon, and petitioner cannot be restored to that which he never possessed. This state would submit that LB was wrongly decided. It doesn't address the constitutional authority to grant pardons or whether that supersedes the legislative authority to limit the effect of a statutory remedy. It doesn't even mention 2A167-5, and it conflates the historical record of conviction with consequences stemming therefrom. The denial of an expungement is not a punishment, it's not a denial of a right, and a CCH, a judicially maintained record, is not a disability. Furthermore, in 2A167-3.1, the governor is required to provide the legislature with the details of the pardon, such as the statutes of which the petitioner was convicted, as well as the dates of conviction. Therefore, some power to require retention of records under the right circumstances lies with the legislature. The state would ask this court to affirm the judgment of the appellate division. And if your honors have any questions, I will be happy to take them.
Yeah, your argument is quite broad as relates to the Constitution and whether there's a constitutional impediment here. So I'd like you to imagine a situation where the legislature modified the expungement statute to say pardons will have absolutely no effect on our judgment. The legal disability that flows from the conviction will remain in effect and pose a bar to expungement, notwithstanding what the governor has done. Would that go too far?
It would not, Your Honor, and I believe it goes back to the language in Brezezecki, that a statutory disqualification can still overcome the fact of the pardon.
I'm having difficulty understanding that argument. If the Constitution provides the governor with pardon power, and the effect of the pardon power is to remove civil disabilities that attach to the conviction, then it would seem to me that the legislature cannot do anything that would in any way circumscribe that power. Am I wrong?
Your Honor, it's the state's position that while the pardon is included in the Constitution, the scope of that pardon is legislatively defined.
Well, then it would mean nothing to say that I could issue a pardon, but the legislature can say that it will have no effect, would seem to allow legislation to completely negate the constitutional provision. That doesn't seem right.
Your Honor, then I think we go back to the case law that discusses how a pardon eliminates the consequences that flow from a conviction, but not the historical fact thereof. And that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about the historical fact of conviction.
So do you agree with the principle that's in Sorcella and other case law that the legal disability is removed?
Your Honor, I would argue that the legal disability stemming from the conviction as it relates to Sorcella, Brezezecki, and Hozier, they're statutorily defined in 168-3 and 167-5. The rights that are being restored are explicitly contained within the statute as being restored by the pardon. Whereas, again, here we're talking about a historical fact of conviction. And I think we get into a really circular argument where we're talking about we've got this fact of conviction that's preventing him from getting an expungement that will remove the fact of conviction.
But wouldn't you agree that it's preventing him from being considered for an expungement, right? That's what petitioner is arguing, that the fact of the pardon gets his foot in the door so that his expungement petition can be considered on the merits. And I think you mentioned earlier during your preliminary statement that none of the safeguards are in place. I mean, how is that the case? Kind of going to Justice Solomon's point earlier, there's going to be a judge sitting there taking all these factors into consideration, taking 5214 into consideration. So how is it that all these safeguards are gone if these individuals are allowed to just get their foot in the door and have their petition argued on the merits?
Well, once he gets his foot in the door, the burden shifts. He goes from being per se barred from an expungement to presumptively eligible. The burden would then shift to the state to argue under Chapter 14 that the need for the records outweighs his interest in an expungement. And I have been unable to find a case where the state has successfully argued to keep those records in place. It is a very high bar. It's a very big swing in burden.
We're about to find out, because depending on what this court does, the first case may come to us. So stay tuned. No, I'm kidding.
What are the basic
arguments? I agree that there are still safeguards. There are still safeguards because the state
they can make those arguments. Any objectors can make those arguments under 5214.
It's very limited, Your Honor. It's limited to the need for retention of records. It doesn't really go to the defendant's character or the petitioner's character. It just simply goes to the retention of records.
I think your position is the retention of records is not per se a civil disability. It's merely the maintenance of records. The civil disability is denying a person the right to vote, employment, and so on and so forth. Those are the disabilities, not the record itself. Is that your position?
That is my position, Your Honor. What remains after Mr. Odom has been pardoned is merely this historical fact of conviction.
I'm trying to figure out what the pardon accomplishes under your definition. And maybe a better way to phrase it is, how is T.O. different from someone who was acquitted or admitted to PTI after a pardon?
Well, Your Honor, I'm sorry, Your Honor, if he's been acquitted after a pardon?
No. He's been pardoned. How is he different than another defendant who was either acquitted or admitted to PTI?
Well, Your Honor, you don't need to admit guilt in order to proceed for an expungement under 52-6, which is where a petitioner who has been either acquitted or had charges dismissed would apply. Those are fast-track expungements. They're pretty much automatically granted. A person does not have to admit guilt to be admitted into PTI, and again, that's controlled by 2C5214F. And a person who has successfully completed PTI can apply for an expungement after 6 months. Whereas the pardon power restores his right to vote. If it has not already been restored, it restores his right to hold office, to own a firearm, many of the same rights that would have been granted had he been eligible for expungement.
So what does the pardon accomplish for T.O. with respect to expungement? Absolutely nothing.
It accomplishes nothing, Your Honor, because that statutory bar is still in place, and T.O. is not within the class of petitioners contemplated by the legislature to be eligible for expungement.
And your position is, if the legislature is intending to expand the constituency of people who are entitled to expungement, it can easily just put in pardons in the statute?
That's correct, Your Honor. When this court addressed JS and GPB, the court said, with a simple adjustment of language, the legislature could have expanded the eligible class, and it chose not to. As recently as 2018, our legislature looked at expanding the eligible pool of petitioners to someone with more than one indictable conviction. That bill only had one sponsor, and it died in committee. 52-2 has been amended, I believe, at least 9 times since it came into existence, and no fewer than 6 times since LB. This bar on 2 convictions still stands. It's clear that the legislature does not want to expand that pool of potential petitioners beyond one indictable.
Other questions? Anything you'd like to add to your presentation?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Radel, did you want to offer a rebuttal?
I have just a handful of very quick points, if I might, and start where Ms. Campbell concluded. It is not, I think, accurate to say that the legislature has not expanded beyond one indictable with the new provisions that are not yet effective, but currently in place, the clean slate provisions would permit that. So the legislature has not foreclosed that possibility in all instances. With respect to the legislative silence, I would take just a slightly different view than Ms. Borden, though not inconsistent, and that is that whether or not the legislature is presumed to know and understand LB to have a preclusive effect, the legislature is presumed to understand that the legal effect of a pardon is, and that that is not a matter of legislation, but a matter of constitutional and common law, and that all of its statutes are going to be interpreted with the legal effect of a pardon in mind. So the fact that the legislature has been silent as to a pardon, I agree, we need give no thought to, because the legislature should be presumed that this enactment, which has a trigger point based upon conviction, would be interpreted in the instance of a pardon like any other statute. With respect to statutes and the possibility that this legislature would enact a provision particularly about pardons, the legislature could always, I think this is sort of a floor and ceiling issue, the legislature could always afford a pardon more than the Constitution and the common law does. So if the legislature wanted to say every offense that's pardoned is an automatic expungement, that's not a separation of powers issue because it's not undermining the executive's authority to issue the pardon. It's offering the pardon more of a benefit than it might have under the constitutional and common law. But what the legislature may not do is either expressly or indirectly limit it by, as Ms. Borden said, you know, keep the pardoned offenders with those that are convicted under a statute. And then finally, just one procedural point to the Chief Justice's question about what would happen on remand. While I agree in general that the provisions of 14 apply, in this case, given the statements of the prosecutor's office, I think that they are bound on remand by their admissions that this petitioner is actually precisely the type of person who's deserving of an expungement. So I don't think that there would be room on this record for that type of analysis.
Thank you, counsel. And thank you to all counsel for the helpful arguments. We'll take them out.